Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. This Sunday, Russians are going to the polls to elect their next president. Over the past few months, tens of thousands of Russians have taken to the streets to protest alleged vote rigging and Vladimir Putin's insistence on returning for a third presidential term after a stint as prime minister. Today's guest, Fred Weir, reports that the Russian elections has been engineered for a Putin victory. His true challenge will come afterward, when he has to rule a country increasingly dissatisfied with his rule. Fred Weir is Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow. Hi, Fred. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
It's great to have you back. So, Fred, before we start and talk about what's happening in Russia, we'd like to start, as you know, on our Friday shows by giving kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, that's a tough one. I think that the best reporting now is coming out of the Middle East, out of Syria. Some incredibly brave journalists are trying to penetrate the cloak of what's going on there. And I just, I read the news every morning on my computer, and I'm just amazed at the work some journalists are doing.
It is incredible. We talked about this actually last week. And just based on what you've read, what is your take on what's happening there and what might happen in the weeks to come?
Well, I think that, that all these, this entire area was carved up from the ruins of the Ottoman Empire by the British and French. And they drew those borders for their own convenience. And Syria is, in a lot of ways, like a bigger version of Lebanon. It's got these sectarian divides, and they were exacerbated by the French in order to facilitate their own rule. That is how a small sect, the Alawites, come to rule Syria. And therefore, I think that certainly, I talked to a lot of Russian experts. They have some really fine Middle Eastern experts about this, and they believe that a massive civil war, like the Lebanese civil wars, is beginning in Syria. It's a really, really grim projection. It may have started as a pro-democracy movement by the urban middle class, but it has mutated into something far more sinister. This fear now is that it's going to just turn into a grueling bloodbath.
We also got a few questions last Friday about Russia's relationship with Syria. What is your read on that, and why is Russia protecting Syria?
Well, I think that they, first of all, I mean, there are many levels in which the Russian position makes sense to them. And one level, undoubtedly, is self-interest. Syria is their oldest and sole remaining Middle Eastern partner. It's been a client state of Moscow since 1971. They have their own only foreign military base there at Tartus. It's a naval refueling station, and a lot of arms contracts and other political relations. And they have noticed, and Putin actually said in his article this week about foreign policy, that when Western-sponsored regime change takes place in countries, as it happened in Iraq and as it happened in Libya, Russian companies get forced out of their traditional markets and replaced by Western companies. That's one Russian objection. They fear that the Western-engineered regime change is going to force them out of Syria. But they also feel that the West doesn't really know what it's doing. This urge, Putin called it the itch to intervene militarily, sometimes outstrips any plan, any rational calculation of what you're attempting to accomplish. This is the Russian position, that they really, the all cloaked with humanitarian rhetoric, they will intervene in a civil war and make it worse. The Russian position is they did that in Libya. And so I think for these various reasons, a mixture of their principle, their pride, and their self-interest, they have dug in their heels, and they're not going to cooperate with any kind of Western intervention in Syria.
You reported last week that Vladimir Putin pledges the largest military buildup since World War II. I haven't really seen this reported in many other places. What did you find there?
Well, he dashed off a series of manifesto-like articles. This is the main substance of his election campaign, actually. And in one of them, he addressed the whole issue of rebuilding Russia's military strength. And indeed, Russia does need to reform its army, reshape it for the 21st century, and re-equip it. It's obvious that they need to do that. So the Putin idea is to throw a lot of money. By Russian standards, it's a lot of money. About $780 billion over the next 10 years to re-equip and reshape Russia's armed forces. This is the biggest military buildup since the Cold War. The Soviet armed forces were much more formidable than Putin has in mind, and he doesn't have a new Cold War in mind, but making Russia a fairly strong player militarily on the world stage, this is what his idea is.
We're speaking with Fred Weir, Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow, and sorry for his line there, but we're connecting with him in Moscow. And Fred will be with us for about another 10 minutes, so if you have any questions for Fred about what's happening on the ground in Russia, and if you have any comments about media coverage of the relationship between Russia and Syria or the election that is happening this Sunday, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. So, Fred, moving on to the election, last time we spoke with you, we talked about the mass protests that are happening across Russia, accusing the government of rigging the votes in the election. There are also so many anti-Putin demonstrations. Give us the latest. What has been happening on the ground in the past month?
Well, first of all, the protest movement has not subsided. I think the Kremlin's calculation was that with the winter and, with a bit of time, that people would calm down. But last Sunday, we had a huge demonstration. It didn't even have a permit. It was like a giant flash mob. Tens of thousands of people joined hands around the Garden Ring, which is this inner road that girdles downtown Moscow. It's 10 miles long, and they have that entire 10-mile space filled with people joining hands, and they weren't allowed to have slogans or posters or anything like that, but they made it very clear that they were out to protest. So the momentum is still there, and it clearly will be after the election. So all eyes are going to be on this voting on Sunday, where it seems likely that Putin will win, that he will be declared the winner. But if there is significant evidence of fraud, as there was in the December parliamentary election, I think we will see another huge eruption of people into the streets next week.
You report that there will be about 50,000 election monitors watching what goes on Sunday. What exactly will be monitored, and what else has come up through social media about alleged vote rigging?
Well, this is really something new for Russia. There hasn't been in the past a big volunteer movement of election monitors. Usually the monitoring in polling stations has been done by paid observers who are paid by political parties to simply watch what goes on. And often, because they're paid, someone else can pay them. It's part of the whole fraud thing that is alleged. But now you have, as a result of the protest and as a result of this upsurge, you have huge numbers. It's estimated about 50,000 people have signed up now to actually be independent observers. They will go to polling stations, and they will record what goes on, do all the things that I assume you have in America. You have in polling stations, you have people who watch and record and check. But in any case, this is what they'll do. They'll watch the process of voting. They'll look for signs of ballot stuffing. They'll look for any other irregularities that might happen. And then when polls close, they will stay to watch the count of the votes. And this is vital, because this is there are about 90,000 polling stations across Russia. In each one, at the end, they count the votes, where people will, the observers will watch that process happen. So they will see the raw vote count, and at the end of each one, there is something drawn up which is called a protocol, which records that raw vote count. And that protocol is then taken to a territorial electoral commission where it's recorded and added to the pile of other polling stations, and observers will follow that. And then it should be transmitted to Moscow, to the Central Electoral Commission. And it is usually in those transmissions from one level to the other where skullduggery takes place. So it will be vital that if you have election monitors in every place with their copies of the raw vote count in each place, and doing it as you go up at each level, tabulating how it should be so that they can then match that with the final count. This will be fascinating to watch, and there's enough people now for the first time ever to do it independently.
We're speaking with Fred Weir, a Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow, and he'll be with us for just a couple more minutes. So if you have a question for Fred or a comment about media coverage, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruby in Mill Valley. Hi, Ruby. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Weir, my question is about elections in general. I've been following the author, Misha, whose last name I'm forgetting, who wrote a book to be published this week, The Man Without a Face, about Putin. And if I've got it correct, in order to run for president, you have to compile a list of 2 million names in a period of 2 weeks over 83 provinces, so which is impossible, I guess. And it sounds like anyone who wants to run for president has to be Kremlin approved. And so that's one confusion I have. Is that true? Am I hearing that correctly? The other big question is this the only election in Russia that is held, the only one, because the lower the Duma, the other elected officials are basically appointed? Am I getting that correct?
I know you were referring to Masha Gessen's new book, which I have not read yet, but Masha is a long-standing observer of Russia, and she does describe the many, many hurdles that are in the process, which make it very, very hard for any independent force, any independent politician to come forward to develop a political base and run for office in a free competition. The political landscape is weeded and hoed and fixed long before ballots are printed. And the people you do see on the ballots are not really the expression of the real political forces that would exist in the country if there were free competition. That's the point she makes. And the 2 million signatures that have to be gathered by a candidate in 20 days, I think it is, makes it really hard. It's just one of many, many things that make it really hard for any independent person, even with a lot of support behind him or her, to get on a ballot in the first place in Russia.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ruby. And also, if you'd like to hear an interview with Masha Gessen, she was on Fresh Air with Terry Gross yesterday, and we'll put a link to that on our website. And before we let you go, Fred, you know, the last time we spoke with you, you said that these uprisings have really taken Russia by surprise because there's just not there aren't many protests that happen in the country. People kind of embrace capitalism there. There's a race to make a lot of money. And this is very new. So what are you hearing from people on the streets, and where do they think this will go?
Well, it's hard to say. Certainly, I think that these protests will continue. And these are the protests not of people who are suffering economically. They're not exactly the analog of, say, Occupy Wall Street.
Right.
Their demands aren't economic. They are political. They're sick and tired of living in a fixed political system. Mm. And to answer Ruby's second question, there are similar types of elections for the lower house of parliament and regional legislatures, but the upper house of parliament is appointed. So these protests have been started, at least, by middle class, relatively prosperous and well-educated urbanites. And although I noticed last Sunday an awful lot of the people were older, middle-aged, and so on, it's still powered largely by the youth, and their main organizing tools are social networks like Facebook and Twitter. But I think it's very possible that this can spread out to the hinterland, where you've got more working-class people. They're suffering very badly from inflation. The economy is... It's not in depression, but it's not good. And it's very hard to gauge what the majority of Russians are thinking. I think that this election, as controlled and managed as it is, will give us at least some impression of what has happened with Putin's former undeniable popularity. I think it will be very interesting to watch.
Because the population is about 143 million?
Yeah, approximately that.
Okay.
And about 90-some million voters.
Mm. Well, we'll definitely follow this, and I think we need to do a show about Russia because there's a lot of interest, and it's really interesting to watch these changes. So thank you so much, Fred. We'll be following your reporting over the weekend.
It is my pleasure.
Thank you. That's Fred Weir. He is a Christian Science Monitor correspondent based in Moscow, and you can see his latest piece for Vladimir Putin, Winning Russia's Presidency May Be the Easy Part. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. And it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We're going to switch gears now and talk about what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico. The massive lawsuit stemming from the 2010 BP oil disaster was scheduled to begin this past Monday in New Orleans, but it's been delayed to give BP and lawyers more time to continue possible settlement talks with 130,000 plaintiffs. Now, if these talks fall through, the trial will begin this Monday, March 5th. And if the case begins on Monday, it'll be the largest environmental lawsuit in history. And joining us to talk about media coverage of this is Abram Lustgarten. He's an investigative journalist who writes about water, energy, and climate for ProPublica. That's a nonprofit investigative news organization. Abram's forthcoming book is called Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. Abram won a 2009 George Polk Award for environmental reporting. Hi, Abram. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. You know, in thinking about doing this segment, it's just amazing that this has fallen off the front pages in the past 6 or so months. First off, why don't you just give us an update about this BP lawsuit? People are now hearing about it, but it's taken a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, well, what you have is it's actually a combination of hundreds of lawsuits. Sometime about a year and a half ago, the court, soon after the spill in the Gulf, the courts decided that that 200 and some plaintiff actions against BP, plus the government's own civil case and several states' lawsuits, would all be combined and heard together in one giant court case. And it's an effort to kind of keep this consolidated and from just rambling on in the courts for decades. And so that is what's coming to a head now, and that's partly why it's so complicated and a little bit difficult to understand, because there are so many different interests and so many different claims involved here.
And so, again, just to remind listeners, we're talking about the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon, which killed 11 people, unleashed the largest oil disaster in U.S. history. It caused almost 5 million barrels of oil to gush into the Gulf. And based on the reporting you've done and the research you did for your book, talk a little bit about the health of the Gulf. What are the people in the Gulf and still facing? And then we'll talk about what the environment is actually facing.
Well, there's something like 6 million barrels or 5.9 billion barrels of oil that were spilled in the Gulf in the 86 days that the Macondo well was gushing before BP was able to close it off. Covered hundreds of miles of coastline, damaged not only the fisheries but the coastal habitat, and affected everything from the ecological well-being of those coastal regions and the tourist communities, the tourist businesses, and a lot of the economy that is related to things besides energy production along the Gulf Coast states. A lot of that, people say that, the damage does not necessarily appear to be as bad as it was thought to be at the time of the Gulf spill, but there is extensive cleanup still to be done. BP has invested, they say, about $21 billion in that cleanup so far. There are reports of great progress, and yet there's still people finding, tar balls on the beaches and increasing numbers of reports of health complaints and health impacts. People suspect that the dispersants that are used to clean up some of the oil are having residual effects on people's health. So there are ongoing issues, and I think it's going to take years and years to really see exactly how this plays out and what damage remains.
And 2 years later, what questions do you think reporters should be asking? Because so many of the reports kind of give you an overview of what's going on and that there might be a possible settlement. But beyond that, what questions should be asked?
Well, the biggest question to me, and this is what I focused on, in my book, and it's what I spend the most time thinking about, is how does BP's history and how does their track record affect, what happens going forward? We will, as a country, undeniably have, a great reliance on oil that comes from the Gulf of Mexico. It's a robust resource, and as far as oil supplies in the world, it's one of the largest. Right now, BP is poised to be, one of the most active, if not the most active, drilling company there. But this is a company that, before the accident on the Deepwater Horizon, had a long track record of accidents, many of them deadly, many of them, very bad for the environment, and has shown an inability to fix the problems that caused those accidents in the past. And there's a lot of strong similarities between what happened in the past and what happened in the Gulf. And so, I think at some point, the conversation and the government scrutiny should turn to the question of, not how do you penalize this company for what happened in April 2010, but do you trust this company to work in, United States territories, at least under the same paradigms, the same set of rules, and develop oil in the United States? Are they going to be the ones that you trust to do it safely?
We're speaking with Abram Lustgarten, an investigative journalist with ProPublica, who's been covering the BP oil disaster. He's got a book coming out about this called Run to Failure. And we are talking about media coverage of what's happening in the Gulf. A massive lawsuit was scheduled to begin on Monday, but BP has delayed this. They are wanting a possible settlement. If the talks fall through, the trial will begin this Monday. It'll be the largest lawsuit in U.S. history on the environment. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KLW San Francisco 91.7 FM. Today's media roundtable. More media criticism is coming your way during the 7 o'clock hour, with left, right, and center at 7 o'clock, then at 7:30, Counterspin, a critical examination of the major stories of the week, presented by FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. KALW has been broadcasting at 91.7 on the FM dial in the Bay Area since 1941. Now with online listening, KALW has listeners worldwide. But just because you live in the Bay Area doesn't mean KALW's online streams aren't for you. If you hear KALW at work but not at home, for example, check out the online listening options at KALW.org. Whether you're on your desktop, your tablet, or your smartphone, you can stay connected. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of KALW.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. And speaking of the environment, we'll have a conversation on Monday about the 9th annual San Francisco Ocean Film Fest, which kicks off next Thursday. How is international awareness about our troubled oceans changing the way people deal with conservation? The Film Fest got a lot of entries from overseas filmmakers, so we'll talk about what effect that's having. And just overall, how can awareness here and abroad save our oceans and underwater life, which are right now in dire straits? So we'll be talking about that on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And we are talking about coverage of the BP oil disaster, which happened in 2010, killed 11 people, caused almost 6 million barrels of oil to gush into the Gulf, the largest oil disaster in U.S. history. And if you have a question or a comment about the media coverage over the past few years, we've done so many shows about how this has affected the health and the environment in the Gulf. And so what are your thoughts on the media's coverage of this? What questions should be asked 2 years after this disaster? And as always, if there was a story you saw that you think deserves more attention, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or better yet, leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Abram Lustgarten, investigative journalist who writes about water, energy, and climate for ProPublica. His forthcoming book is Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. And now I would like to welcome David Hammer to the show. David is a staff writer with the Times-Picayune. Last year, David won the Society of Environmental Journalists Award for reporting on the risky decisions and lax safety practices that led to the explosion. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me again, Ruth.
Great to have you. So we were talking with Abram about the pending lawsuit. What does media coverage look like in your area, in the Gulf?
Well, I mean, we're covering it full bore, obviously. This is the biggest litigation of its kind, and when you consider the potential fines that we're looking at here, that it's probably the biggest litigation in history when you look at it in terms of dollars and cents. So we're focused on it as much as we possibly can with mustering all of our resources. But it's difficult because there's a lot of closed-door negotiations going on right now, and the people involved are very tight-lipped, and they're keeping it as a close cadre of folks involved in the negotiations to prevent any kind of leaks from getting out. There's been a lot of speculative stories in the media around the country about where things stand and how much the settlement might come together for, and that I think is pretty dangerous because a lot of that can affect stock prices and other things, and the values could be floated out there by corporations for their own benefit or to push an agenda toward a set negotiated settlement or against it. So I think we've tried to stay away from speculative stories.
So because it's difficult to get this kind of information, and we've had so many reporters over the last couple of years say that it's been very difficult to deal with a corporation, a multinational like BP, where does that leave you and other journalists? How are you getting this information?
Well, I mean, we have sources who are involved, whether it's in the litigation or in the investigation side. You know, don't forget there's a criminal investigation in full swing here. So there are a lot of angles to this. Plus, you know, we get we mine the court documents, and then we are also have been fortunate to get some that have not been made public officially, but we get them, and we can see things like a BP official telling another to keep quiet about what their expert is telling them could be the amount of oil flowing out in the days after the spill, or after the explosion and the sinking of the Deepwater Horizon, and that could be a critical piece of evidence in terms of determining whether individuals should be charged with crimes. So there are things like that that we just are continuously trying to mine and uncover, and that's how we've gotten around the fact that, of course, from an official standpoint, these corporations aren't going to say a lot.
Right. And Abram, what has your experience been like in terms of accessibility? I understand you weren't able to get interviews with BP executives.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit of a different approach. I'm not down there or actively, trying to cover the trial. So it's a different kind of sourcing problem. A lot of my focus was on trying to understand what happens inside the company, and especially in years past. So there's one challenge of finding people who work for the company or its contractors or did sometimes past. And that's really just kind of from a journalistic standpoint, that's a networking challenge. The company itself, BP, has been, reticent to openly engage in conversation about, its track record, its safety issues, or of course, what's happening, what's unfolding now in the courts. And in large part, as David said, that's because there's a criminal investigation ongoing as well. And for lots of other, obvious reasons. David also mentioned that, the court records are voluminous at this point, on BP, and not just around what happened in the Gulf of Mexico, but much that has to do with the company's history going back a couple of decades. And so, for somebody who has the patience and the time to go look for stuff, there is just an incredible amount of detail and information and depositions and past statements by executives and just a lot of interesting information there. But I have to agree wholeheartedly on a lot of the speculation that's been out there in the past week. I think all of us in the media, we have editors looking for our stories and they want to know what's happening and they were kind of all geared up to start covering this trial last week or to write something, and now, we're kind of spinning our wheels a little bit waiting. And I think that it is dangerous to try to push out there, speculative ideas about what kind of settlement might be reached, for exactly the reasons that David just mentioned.
Well, we've got a few callers on this, so let's hear from Kevin in Ben Lomond. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you. I'm interested in the question of whether, to what extent, expert testimony will be part of the trial proceedings, and I assume it will be. And do your guests have any expectation in regard to how empirical or honest agencies like the National Marine Fisheries Service will be as to their assessment of the environmental damage, or whether instead they'll be under intense political pressure to soft soap the damage, which was pretty clear during the actual event as I watched it on the media? That's my question.
Thank you. David, do you want to take those?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I can tell you definitively that there are 61 expert witnesses that are currently on the schedule to be called. Right near the top is Bob B., who is a professor at Cal Berkeley, who's been very involved in investigating what went wrong from the very beginning, feeding his reports to the White House and the public, and he actually has some interesting experience to share, because he was actually hired by BP, I can't remember how long ago, I think it was in the 90s, to make an assessment of their corporate safety culture, and was not particularly happy with the way that his report was received, and I think that his testimony is going to go to that point to a great detail. What was the other question?
Expert testimony.
Right. Well, that's what I'm referring to, expert testimony.
Oh, the other question, I'm sorry, it was about government agencies. Do you think that they'll have to downplay what they really know because of political pressure?
That's you mean in terms of a potential conflict because the Minerals Management Service was in a way complicit because they had not been enforcing their regulations properly and things like that. It's interesting because we've already had a very exhaustive accident report filed jointly by the successor of the Minerals Management Service, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, along with the Coast Guard. And they went ahead and issued citations against BP, Transocean, and Halliburton. And there was some, you know, admission that they, you know, need to beef up their processes but in that report. But mostly what they've done is they've just simply changed the regulatory structure and renamed the whole agency and beefed up their inspections and what have you, and are trying to kind of establish a new structure for regulating the industry offshore.
Hmm. Well, and on the question of political pressure, David, Abram, I'd like to ask you about a piece that ran in Mother Jones last month called White House Pressured Scientists to Underestimate BP Spill Size. This was by Kate Shepard. And she wrote about an email released by Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, and they traced efforts to downplay the spill size in the initial weeks back to the White House. What can you tell us about that?
To be honest, I haven't read that story or followed it very closely, you know, so I can't comment specifically. You know, I can just, from a 10,000-foot view, I mean, the Obama administration has been under and put itself under enormous pressure to handle this, you know, this crisis from when it began in 2010, not just in terms of response and environmental response, but politically, you know, and I think that's put them in some pretty, you know, thorny territory right off the bat.
Right. Well, and to be specific, the group released an email from May 2010 from Dr. Marcia McNutt, director of the U.S. Geologic Survey and head of the government's flow rate technical group. The email came after scientists on the flow rate team complained about how the spill figures were conveyed to the press. And in response, she cited pressure from the White House as the reason the numbers were lowballed. What are your thoughts, David, about the role the Obama administration has played in this and the media coverage of it?
Well, you know, I had conversations actually with NOAA a long time ago about that very issue, where they and Dr. McNutt has actually addressed this in some speeches that she's made over the course of the last couple years, where they acknowledged that things were not handled in the best way. And, you know, the way that they present, a lot of it was the messaging. I mean, and that's what calls into question the role of the White House potentially, as well as some questions that were raised about the way the White House, or at least Washington insiders, may have gotten involved in how the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management and Coast Guard report was put together. The head of the investigation for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management actually resigned during the process of putting out that report. And while that was never addressed publicly, exactly the reasons behind it, I can tell you that it definitely stemmed from pressure and changes, multiple changes that were made to that report before it was made public. So there's definitely been some hand here by the White House, and of course, most publicly, you saw the White House getting involved in trying to, you know, in negotiating with BP to set up a $20 billion fund to pay for damages. So they've certainly been involved. And so once you get involved to that extent, then you want to try to control the message. And there was an issue back in August 2010 where they talked about the fate of the oil, and they put out a graphic that showed how much of the oil had been dissolved and how much of the oil was on the surface. And when it was described by top senior White House staff on television, it was not described properly. And that was a big black eye for the White House in that regard, because it was actually put forward in the graphic correctly by NOAA and Dr. McNutt's office, but it was not Carol Browner, who's an advisor to the president, described it incorrectly on national television news shows. So that added to this feeling that there's a kind of a whitewash going on.
That is David Hammer. He's a staff writer with the Times-Picayune. We're also joined by Abram Lesgarden, an investigative reporter with ProPublica, and we're talking about media coverage of the BP oil disaster. The lawsuit was scheduled to begin this past Monday, but it's been delayed to give BP and lawyers more time to continue possible settlements with 130,000 plaintiffs. Now, if these talks fall through, the trial will begin this Monday. It'll be the largest environmental lawsuit in U.S. history. And if you'd like to join us, if you have questions for our guests about their reporting on this issue, or if you have comments about media coverage of this, did you see much coverage about, for example, the Obama's role in these latest emails that came out last month? And what questions do you think the reporters should be asking on this? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Frank in Mountain View. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I followed a lot of the details, and so I understand as best I can the reasons why this bill occurred and the chain of events that led up to it. I guess I'm looking for more coverage. I think the last gentleman talked about the fate of the oil. We've heard everything from, you know, some of the oil evaporated, some was dispersed, bacteria ate the other, and there's, you know, a foot or two layer of brown goo in a bunch of chunks. And I'm thinking about there's also a huge spill, I think it was Brazilian, offshore, just in the last year or two also. I don't really see any media coverage about long-term environmental studies, surveys, and really, is the government doing enough to do the proper research on the impact of that oil?
Yeah. You know, we did a show about what's going on in Nigeria. They have one of these disasters once a year. What about that larger question, Abram, about government studies of this issue and where this goes from here, if this changes any policy in the United States?
Well, I don't think you're going to see a change of policy, at least in the short term, and that's in part because it takes a very long time to see, you know, the kind of effects that we would expect to see, you know, or at least might watch for from a spill like this. It's also important to remember that, you know, the Gulf is not a pristine environment. There are many small spills happening frequently, and not just you know, oil spills, but also you know, environmental impacts associated with chemical production and all the other industries that are along the Gulf Coast. You know, as far as you know, government study, I'm not aware of specific work that's going on now, but you know, it's going to be 10 years, 20 years, or longer before you really see the impacts. And people are still talking about what happened, you know, what the lasting effects are of the Exxon Valdez spill, you know, in 1989, you know, off the coast of Alaska.
And they're still trying to get justice for that.
They are, yep. And I mean, that's also a sign of how long this protracted court argument, you know, the court fight that we're about to see start with BP could last.
Right. David, how is your paper covering the long-term impacts of this and also the human costs, the environmental costs?
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's the crazy thing about trying to get a settlement worked out, a global settlement right now, is that you've got to establish environmental damages in the natural resource damage assessment, and that could take a long time to get any kind of definitive figure. I mean, BP has already set aside $1 billion for that, and we assume that it's going to be a lot more than that at the end. And that's already more than was paid for natural resources damages in the Valdez spill. So, you know, the idea that they're going to come up with some kind of definitive figure that's going to settle this forever right now in that regard is very hard to swallow, especially when we're still trying to figure out the effects, you know, on the fisheries and, you know, and plus human health concerns. I mean, We still are finding oils in the waters off of Louisiana's coast. As recently as last week, there were some reports, particularly by plaintiffs groups that are going out in boats and they're still gathering data. There's still health concerns, but no solid evidence to definitively tie respiratory illnesses that have been reported from those who worked on vessels of opportunity. Those were the boats that went out that BP paid through subcontractors to go do the cleanup. And then you've got these dolphin deaths that continue to, I mean, there was a brucellosis outbreak before the spill even happened, but it appears that the spill certainly exacerbated it because you have a traditional average of about 70 mammal strandings a year, but there were 122 in the first 6 months after the spill and then 424 in the last 16 months, including 48 just in the first 2 months of this year.
48.
So, yeah.
You know, I'm glad you brought this up because I'm now Facebook friends with a number of people who live in the Gulf, and they have been posting photos of dead dolphins, asking people to call the White House to say what is going on here.
But what are you going to – and that's the, here's the key when you try to – you know, the big thing we have to keep in mind about this about any kind of settlement or trial resolution is that it will, we would hope it would be a deterrent and that it would cause oil companies to really, really make major changes because they can't afford to let this happen again because they won't survive if it does. And, you know, you look at these dolphin deaths and you want to say, okay, here we are, we've got this empirical evidence, but then you're confronted by the problem of having had a brucellosis outbreak that increased the numbers of strandings before the spill even happened, and you can have these companies obfuscate these facts very easily if it were to go to trial. So it's just very, very difficult in a sweeping, wide-ranging thing like this to be able to nail things down.
Mm. Well, we've got a couple more calls. I want to get them in before we have to end. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Well, let me just quickly turn down my radio. Sorry for the delay. The question I had, and I think maybe you started to touch on it, and I hope you can still hear me.
Yes.
Is that the long-term effects, I mean, this could go on for decades. I mean, we don't know still where the oil that was spilled, that was dispersed, where that went, because it certainly all didn't wash up on the beaches in the Gulf. And so the question becomes, once they settle this thing, if they settle it, 20 years from now or 10 years from now, you're going to have people coming down with cancers and all kinds of things. What kind of legal liability do they have, if they do have any, once this has been settled with the company and the people who have been injured, et cetera?
Thanks. We'll get an answer in just a minute. Let's hear from Alan in Monterey. Hi, Alan. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Rose. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Well,
not so good. We're hearing about dolphins dying in the Gulf.
Well, you got me all stirred up, so, you know, here we go. Here goes. I interviewed five PhDs about 9 months ago, and they gave me numbers. Yes, of course, there was 11 humans blown off the rig and that died horrendous deaths, but, you know, there was 34,000 dolphins, 6,000 sea turtles, 8,000 seabirds. They said to multiply this by a factor of 10, so the true death toll is about 48,011 animals and humans. Now, they're not talking about, you know, I'm glad finally we got away from the spill and started talking about the dolphins, because the outbreak was one thing, but the number of dolphins that have aborted their babies because the animals are seemingly have foreign bodies in them, the toxic substances make them, you know, give the babies back. So they, I mean, there's hundreds of dolphins that have washed up babies, and no one's talking about that, but yet we still are, you know, looking at the issues of Alaska, where 22 years later, yeah, they lost the herring fishery in the first year, but 22 years later, it's never come back because, again, the toxins get into their bodies and kill the adults off, but you know, BP has no intention of paying any of this. It's all kind of happy talk to me. They've kept these guys in court for 30 years. 3,000 litigants have died, you know, and they will just litigate to oblivion. So why don't we just, you know, get right back to an active boycott of BP and its subsidiaries, like Conoco and Safeway Gas. And,
well, thank you for calling. Sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time. Abram, what are your thoughts on this and just the long-term consequences here? Will people have any redress in, say, 10 or 20 years? What happens then?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my initial thought in hearing both of those questions is that at some point these become policy and societal questions and not liability questions. Right. I mean, you can't just take a company like BP as egregious as their behavior may be, and endlessly hold them responsible for every kind of bad environmental indicator that you see going decades into the future. At some point, you want to look to your government, your regulators, to enforce, regulations that are in place to make the drilling as environmentally sustainable as possible. And you also want to look at society and say, if we want to continue to use energy at the rate that we do and continue to rely on fossil fuels at the rate that we do, then it can't be coupled with an expectation that there isn't environmental damage in places like Valdez, Alaska, or the Gulf of Mexico. There's a trade-off, and I don't think that you can just, expect those services and those products on a daily basis and then expect to hold, the industry alone liable, when those impacts are seen into the future. And so there's a really bigger picture here.
And David, your response, about 30 seconds.
Yeah, Abram's right. I mean, these companies, if they're going to continue to provide the energy that we insatiably use, they can't have these indefinite reopeners in these settlements. You know, that when they get a settlement, as egregious as their activity may have been, they have to get some kind of certainty for their stock price for them to be able to continue to operate. And so how they're going to, how the plaintiffs might have reopeners to be able to get back at this later on if something else pops up is going to be limited.
Yep, and they're still giving money to politicians. I will put a link to the Open Secrets page on BP at yourcallradio.org. David Hammer is a staff writer with the Times-Picayune, and Abram Lustgarten is an investigative journalist with ProPublica, author of the forthcoming book, Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And thanks for your questions. We'll be following this lawsuit and definitely covering it in the weeks to come. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. How is international awareness about our troubled oceans changing the way people deal with conservation? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the 9th annual San Francisco Ocean Film Fest, which kicks off this Thursday. The festival celebrates the sea with inspirational films intended to increase our appreciation of the oceans. This year, the festival is showing several international films. So how can awareness save our oceans and underwater life? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Eric Jansen is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, we get an update on the latest political news on the GOP presidential race with Washington Post reporter Felicia Sanmez. The Occupy Wall Street movement gears up for phase two this spring. And musician Rodrigo Sanchez of the acoustic rock group Rodrigo E. Gabriela talks about their new project, Area 52, on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Tavis Smiley Show coming your way just an hour from now at 12 noon here on KALW San Francisco, 91.7 FM. Coming up on 11 o'clock and time for the broadcast of World Have Your Say, recorded just 1 hour earlier for rebroadcast at this time here on KALW San Francisco. It's 11 o'clock.
After a month under siege, Bab al-Ahmar in Syria needs humanitarian help. Supplies can't get in.
The top priority is the evacuation of the seriously wounded, the injured, the sick, men, women and children who have been stuck there for days.
7 lorry loads of food and medical supplies were supposed to have arrived at the most battered part of Homs by now, but government forces aren't letting the aid convoy into the district. The International Committee of the Red Cross says the situation's unacceptable. We'll be getting them to answer your questions. Our Facebook page is also buzzing with comments about whose responsibility it is to intervene in Syria. Shola Inmina says the international community should stay away. Do you agree? It's me, Maddie Savage, taking your call. In the studio, welcome to World Have Your Say.